From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Chris Sitterick. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the national debate over abortion comes to Massachusetts' backyard.
Well, if you're pro-choice, basically you're apoplectic, and if you're pro-life, you're celebrating and cheering and declaring victory.
Also today, MIT President Emerita Susan Hockfield on how biology and engineering must come together to change our world for the better.
We're looking at a population of over 9.7 billion by 2050. We're not going to get there if we don't develop technologies that will allow us to provide for energy, food, water, health, and health care sustainably.
And musician Mehmet Ali Sandlakhol on his most ambitious composition to date.
After such a period of internalization of these different musical languages, I am able to combine them in ways where it's my voice now.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sitterick. And we start today with the simmering debate over abortion, which is reverberating nationally and here in New England. Just this morning, Missouri Senate passed a bill to ban abortions after 8 weeks of pregnancy, without exceptions. The Missouri State House will now take up the measure. That move comes within a day of Alabama's governor signing into law what is widely considered the most restrictive abortion law in the U.S. Meanwhile, closer to home, Rhode Island's Senate Judiciary Committee rejected a bill yesterday that would have codified the right to an abortion in state law. Patrick Anderson, reporter for the Providence Journal, joins us now from the Rhode Island State House. Patrick, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me.
So I have to ask you right out the gate, this bill passed the House. It didn't even get to a vote in the Senate. Were you surprised by that?
Well, we understood that this was the likely outcome in the week or so before the vote, but it's still shocking to ever see a bill voted down in committee. It's very rare to happen because the leadership in the state legislature has so much power, and they usually will just push a bill through if it makes it that far. So it was a very rare thing to see, and also a very intense series of events, even if we kind of expected it.
I think for some of us here in Massachusetts, there was initial surprise seeing this. But can you give us a sense? We tend to think of Rhode Island as pretty blue, but it's a little more complicated than that, isn't it?
It is. I mean, it's similar to Massachusetts politically in a lot of ways, but the Democratic Party is a little more conservative or centrist. It's a little bit of a vestige of the old machine politics, and the leaders probably are a little bit further to the right in the Democratic Party here than in most other very blue states. And the fact that there really isn't a viable Republican Party actually makes that, I think, a little bit more the case, because there aren't the usual Republican-Democratic divides and polarization that sorts voters along these issues.
So with this bill specifically, I know critics, including the Providence Bishop Thomas Tobin, said that this goes way beyond Roe v. Wade. But the language of the actual bill spells out it only applied, quote, prior to fetal viability, that specifically prohibited partial birth abortions. Is it accurate to say that this would have been an expansion of abortion rights? And do you feel that there was an accurate understanding of what the bill would actually do for the people of Rhode Island?
According to the proponents of the bill and those who wrote it, absolutely not. It's not an expansion. Now, lawyers have been and can and will be debating that on both sides endlessly. The pro-life folks believe it is. The pro-choice folks believe it isn't. There are protections. You know, there's still the federal ban on partial birth abortion, just still very much in effect, and some of the older laws that would be stricken if this passed have never been used. But really, the debate has focused on later term abortions. That's where the opponents of this bill have focused and have said that this would make those possible, but the advocates of the bill say that's not the case. and that there's no danger of that at all.
Yeah. Speaking of those advocates, we spoke earlier with the bill's lead sponsor, State Senator Gail Golden, who was talking with us about the defeat. She said it was particularly hard to take because it fell on the same day that Alabama passed their most restrictive ban in the country. And so let's take a listen to what she said.
The Senate bill being voted down this week is deeply alarming. I feel the fear and the anger of women, not only in Rhode Island, but around the country. We are at this time in our nation where there is just a constant attack on women, and we're at a moment where we're fighting for who gets control.
So folks on that side obviously upset, but you also had a number of Catholic leaders, conservative officials who were celebrating the result. What are you hearing in terms of reaction on the ground?
It break down as you'd expect. Wherever you come down on this issue, in the culture war, you're either excited or disappointed. I guess the middle ground would maybe be some of the elected officials who are still having to deal with this, and even some of them that are pro-life personally realize that they are in a difficult spot and that this issue takes all the oxygen out of the debate on anything else, and it's so politically charged it could create a lot of vulnerabilities in the upcoming election, not to mention things like passing a budget this year. Basically the reaction, what from the church and from pro-life folks was celebration, cheering, even to the point in some cases of gloating a little bit in the hallways after the vote, and just despondency and despair among the pro-choice folks after the vote.
Speaking of the church, I know Rhode Island has a pretty significant Catholic population. According to the Public Religion Research Institute, it's the most Catholic state in the country. Past bills kind of like this one have struggled to even make it out of committee. This one did get passed in the House. Would you say it's fair to say that the religious influence is waning in Rhode Island at all?
It might be waning, but that doesn't mean it's gone. It's definitely, there is an influence. It's just about measuring it. If you saw this bill flying through, you could say maybe it has waned. There's also, an issue, there's legislation, pending here, about the statute of limitations and that relates to priest sexual abuse cases. That is also on the church's mind. And so far they've been able to avoid an extension of the statute of limitations, but that's also in the mix here. So far they've been able to hold out on these two hot-button issues, but who knows how long that will be.
Yeah. Obviously, this issue isn't going away anytime soon. It's expected to be a big part of the 2020 presidential race. What's next for pro-choice folks in Rhode Island? Are there other legislative options that they could potentially pursue?
Yeah, this isn't dead. The Democratic leadership is looking at compromise options. And the question is whether the pro-choice folks will accept them, whether they'll see that as watering down the bill. I mean, the most frequently mentioned compromise would be to further define the exception for the health of the mother of when you could have a later term abortion, and redefining the health exemption. So that has been talked about. It's unclear whether pro-choice advocates will go for that or decide that it's better to hold out and feel like they have the public opinion on their side. They have the political momentum on their side, and just keep trying until the pressure builds and this version goes through.
And I just should note, I mentioned the term partial birth abortion. I should have said a procedure known medically as intact dilation and extraction. That's Patrick Anderson, reporter for the Providence Journal. Patrick, thanks for joining us. Really appreciate the time.
Really appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
want to bring in another voice on this issue, and joining me now in the studio to talk about the implication of the challenges to abortion access across the country is WBUR's legal analyst Nancy Gertner. She's a retired federal judge and also senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. Judge Gertner, thanks for being here. Appreciate
it. Good to be here.
And before we go on, I just want to note right out the gate here that you worked on the 1980 case Moe v. Hanley, which established the right to legal abortion in Massachusetts based on the state's constitution.
Right.
So let's start with this news out of Rhode Island. Are you surprised to see a bill of this nature not even make it to a vote in the Senate?
Well, in one sense, yes, and in one sense, no. You need a better answer than that. But in one sense, the pro-choice people are trying to – these are ceremonies to some degree, because all the things that this bill tried to do by legislation – Roe v. Wade does by constitutional interpretation. In other words, it really wasn't necessary to do this, and presumably they did it in order to make a point, which is to say something about the support for choice in Rhode Island. So in that sense, it's a failure that doesn't make sense because it's really not doing anything other than Roe v. Wade did. The post-viability abortions that are in the statute say are really track the language of Roe v. Wade for post-viability abortions. That there was a 5-4 vote out of the Senate after the there was tweeting by members of the Catholic Church that shouldn't have surprised me, but it doesn't mean that the battle is over.
Yeah, I should note, I think that's what proponents were trying to do, was enshrine the protections under Roe v. Wade, and we'll get to whether there could be potential challenges to that legally speaking. But let's look at this in a national context, because it's not just Rhode Island. We mentioned Alabama and Missouri. You also have Georgia, Mississippi, and Ohio who have passed laws effectively banning abortions as soon as the heartbeat of a fetus is detectable. That's around 6 weeks, which is around the same time that most women would realize they're pregnant.
Right.
So it's essentially banned. What do you make of the national push going on right now?
Well, it's a push that was emboldened by President Trump's two latest appointees to the Supreme Court. Both Justice Gorsuch and Justice Kavanaugh, in their previous writings, have made it clear where they stand on this issue. So this is a movement that is sort of betting on a 5-4 reversal of Roe v. Wade, assuming Justice Roberts will go along with that. And I think that that's actually a serious question mark. Most commentators believe that the Supreme Court won't take these statutes now, that Roberts would prefer things to continue as they have been, which is, sadly, regulating abortion out of existence, regulating even first trimester abortions out of existence, so that you don't have to take on Roe v. Wade head on in the way these laws do. So that would mean, what that would mean is that essentially the Supreme Court would decline to take these cases. It has no obligation to take them at all. The cases that are currently before the Supreme Court are the usual fare of increasing the regulation for abortion providers, where the focus is on regulating abortion providers and not abolishing the procedure. So they're all banking on a changed Supreme Court.
Yeah, they're coming right out and saying it. At a hearing last week, Alabama State House Rep. Terry Collins, who sponsored the Alabama bill, called her own bill unconstitutional. She said, all our pro-life bills are unconstitutional right now. That's the goal. So clearly, as you're talking about, they're going for the wholesale overturn of Roe v. Wade.
Right.
Do you see the Supreme Court taking up a case that challenges, say, the Alabama law?
I don't see the Supreme Court taking it up now. I think that the Supreme Court has its plate full again on cases that are dealing with, admitting privileges for doctors who perform abortions when they never had to have admitting privileges at a hospital before. Down the line, who knows? This is a little bit in the weeds for your listeners, but last term and this term, just about a week ago, the Supreme Court overturned 40-year-old precedent, not with respect to abortion, to be sure, but it was up for 40-year-old precedent on other constitutional matters. Last year, they did the same thing. This year, the Breyer wrote a dissent to the decision in which he cited to the Casey decision. And Casey's a 1992 decision, which reaffirmed the right to choose. So it was as if he was saying in his dissent, hey, are you going to do this to abortion next?
Yeah.
He was sort of flagging the issue. So there's the question is this: how much? What's the temper? What's the desire of the court to overturn precedent? Period. And these past two cases suggest that they're not. This isn't a problem for some members of the court. And then this particular precedent, which is precedent with respect to a very highly contested issue. And the third alternative is, or I'll just keep on the road of effectively making abortion rarer and rarer.
Yeah. I have to say, you're underestimating Radio Boston and its listeners. We talked with your colleague, Lawrence Lessig, actually, about that 1992 case earlier this week. I think that people are looking at the makeup of the court, and you have how would you break down where we know justices are going to rule? Is it basically 4-4 with Roberts as a potential swing vote?
4-4 with Roberts as a potential swing vote. Justice Kavanaugh has, you know, I don't even know how to say this, a more complicated approach. So he would want to look more at the facts, but the bottom, as opposed to a Justice Gorsuch, who seems more flat out ready to overturn this precedent. But Kavanaugh winds up on the wrong side of the issue in just about every case. So it's 4-4 with Roberts in between. From what we understand, Roberts' personal views are probably against the Roe v. Wade decision, but he is, as people describe him, an institutionalist. And an institutionalist has to care that the court is willy-nilly overturning precedent.
Yeah, but there was that opinion issued overturning a 40-year-old precedent.
Right.
And in the majority opinion, Justice Thomas said basically stare decisis, past decisions aren't the be-all, end-all, and we can overturn those when we feel it's appropriate.
It's actually even worse than that. There's a Federalist Society document that I found that says activist judges are not judges who overturn legislation or overturn former precedents. Activist judges are those who don't overturn precedents when they're clearly opposed to the Constitution. I wish I had known that when I was on the bench.
I mean, talk a little bit, if you can, about kind of the scope of what we're dealing with here. If the court were to take up a challenge of this nature, what kind of issues are we looking at in terms of how we define personhood and life in this country, and what kind of trickle-down effects?
Right now, if Roe v. Wade is overturned, and let's say you revert to the status quo before that decision, the status quo before that decision was abortion protection was a patchwork quilt across the country. There were states that had right to choose laws. New York was one. Massachusetts was sort of on the fence. And then states that barred abortion. So you'd return to that. In Massachusetts, we would be protected, in my view. And we'd be protected because of the 1980 decision that me and my husband, John Reinstein, did, which would situate the right to choose under the privacy provisions of the Massachusetts Constitution. So you would expect state Supreme Courts that have, you know, that are arguably more liberal to follow along with that. New York might be one. California would be one. Vermont. You'd almost track the same-sex marriage decisions in the state courts across the country. That would mean, again, as it had been before Roe v. Wade, abortion will be legal in certain parts of the country. Abortion would be illegal in other parts of the country. So it would be a patchwork quilt.
So here in Massachusetts, we know back in July, the state passed the Nasty Women Act, repealing a number of these kind of antiquated state laws that restricted abortion, contraception, adultery, among other things. I'm wondering, do you see anything that Massachusetts would need to do to shore up those protections? What would Massachusetts' situation be if Roe v. Wade was overturned?
Well, I don't. This is a strategic question, not a legal question. So, legally, it seems to me that Moe v. Hanley, this 1980 decision, establishes that the reasoning under the Massachusetts Constitution is even stronger. It says privacy. It says the right of a woman to make that decision fits under the privacy provisions of the Massachusetts Constitution. So I think things are protected. In order to make sure there's legislation that's currently pending, the Roe Act is currently pending that tries to undo the incursions on abortions even in a state in which they're legal, like forcing teens to get permission from their parents or a judge to access abortions. And then there is the ever controversial post-viability abortion. And in the Roe Act, it expands access after 24 weeks, that's after viability, in cases of fatal fetal anomalies. So I guess what I'm saying is the right would be protected pre-viability. The regulation under the Moe v. Hanley, the current restrictions would still be in place. This act is trying to eliminate even those restrictions. But yeah. let me just say one thing. The contested territory is certainly the post-viability abortions, and they are very few and far between. I had a case when I was a judge of an abortion with respect to a fetus that had no brain. And so people have to understand what post-viability abortions tend to look like.
Right. There's one other kind of tangent I want to ask you about, and that's IVF, how all this debate could basically translate to that. If you're arguing life begins at conception, it came up during the Alabama debate, and one of these state senators said, the egg in the lab doesn't apply. It's not in a woman. She's not pregnant. I'm wondering how you see that from a legal perspective.
Well, it seems to me it's a slippery slope, as we say, right? I mean, if the fertilized egg is determined to be a person, then it has implications for IVS. It has implications for certain kinds of contraception. If the Supreme Court ever went in that direction, it's literally the whole ball of wax of reproductive rights, which let me take a page from Justice Ginsburg's book. Justice Ginsburg actually believed that Roe v. Wade was wrongly decided. Not the outcome, but the rationale. And she said that abortion should have been seen as an issue of gender discrimination. It should be part of the package of rights that women need to have to determine whether to bear or beget children, and that it was not a privacy issue at all, but a discrimination issue. And if they had gone in that direction, it would have been a different situation.
All right. Obviously, we will keep following that story. I want to pivot for just a moment here while we have you. President Trump just spoke from the Rose Garden to launch his new immigration proposal. The White House is calling it, quote, a sweeping modernization of our dysfunctional legal immigration process. End quote. NPR's reporting, the focus of the plan is to encourage high-skill workers to come to the U.S. And discourage immigration based on family ties. Immigrants seeking to enter the U.S. would basically have to pass a civics test, and they'd get points based on their English proficiency, for example, or certain skills they're bringing to the table. Obviously, this administration has introduced immigration plans before that have been challenged legally. What do you make of what the president is rolling out today?
To the extent that he's changing the rules to get into the country, Congress is going to have to vote that. And that they haven't been so happy with bipartisan immigration reform. To the extent that he's narrowing asylum, he keeps on coming up head on with international treaties about asylum. In other words, we can't mess around with asylum when we are party to certain kinds of treaties. And I think the other thing I have to say is a personal matter. My relatives would have been kept out. My relatives came from, you know, shtetls in Poland and Hungary. They could barely speak English, and even their native tongue, they certainly couldn't read or write.
Yeah.
So it's.
Is there a case to be made, though, for we have to draw a line somewhere, encouraging people who are offering certain skills or whatever to come in? Isn't there?
They could.
A case to be made,
there's no question you can draw that line. That line, however, is a very different line than we have ever drawn, you know, at least to the turn of the century.
Right.
And I would venture to say that President Trump's relatives probably would have been barred like mine.
Well, that's Judge Nancy Gertner. She's a retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR's legal analyst. Judge Gertner, thanks as always for your time.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, how biology and engineering are coming together to solve our biggest problems. I'm Chris Siderick, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Chris Siderick. All right, for this next one, I'm going to try out my movie trailer guy voice for a second.
In a world where viruses work together for good, to build things like batteries. A world in which proteins can filter water, and tiny microscopic particles can help doctors detect cancer.
That's actually not a new summer sci-fi blockbuster. It's real life, according to MIT's Susan Hockfield. Hockfield served as the first female president of MIT, and with a background in biology, she was also the first life scientist to lead the institution. She's out with a new book that gives us something we all need a little bit these days, a hopeful picture of the future, with biology and engineering working together to solve some of our most intractable problems. The book is called The Age of Living Machines, How Biology Will Build the Next Technology Revolution. Susan Hockfield, welcome to Radio Boston.
I'm so happy to be here, Chris.
So I want to start with this central idea, the title of your book. What is a living machine? Tell us what that's all about.
So living machines are a range of new kinds of technologies. The key one that I try to convey its importance in the book is that the things we love today, our cell phones, for example, these microphones, are built with physical parts. Physical parts that were developed out of the parts list of physics that was decoded around 1900. But starting about 1950, we began to develop a parts list for biology. So the living machines I describe in the book use, rather than a nut or a bolt, uses a piece of biology as part of the technology to make that new technology work.
I mean, it's pretty incredible stuff when you, those ideas of a virus building batteries, it sounds sci-fi. One of the things I was struck by reading through your book, it does feel accessible for someone like me who doesn't have this background in science. Can you talk about the challenge of talking about cutting-edge research with folks who maybe are coming from a different world?
One of the great joys of being president of MIT is that I had this extraordinary view over the frontier of discovery and innovation. And what I saw out there was amazing and exciting, optimistic, and very promising. And I'm very keen to share that optimism and those possibilities with people who may not normally hear about them. And the book is designed to explain the possibilities to a general audience. There's a little bit of, self-discipline that's required to convey scientific and engineering principles to people who may not have that background. But I think it's critically important that we do.
I was reading about the viruses building batteries, and the idea came to this woman, Angela Belcher, who was dismissed as insane when she first came up with this idea, but basically found these shells and the way that they built their structures, realized, wait a minute, I can use that. And I just found that aha moment that you talk about to be really interesting. And if you could talk a little bit about that discovery and kind of that moment of we can use this.
Yeah, so I wanted to share this incredible courage and a passion for discovery that animates and gives rise to the ideas that lead to the products that we love through a very circuitous path. And I wanted to give people a sense of just how crazy it seems when people first get hold of an idea that no one else believes.
Right.
So Angie Belcher, a colleague of mine at MIT, a biomaterial scientist now, was in school at UC Santa Barbara, and she loved walking along the ocean. Who doesn't? But the thing that Angie loved was looking at the abalone shell. Now, abalone is a sea snail that lives in the Pacific Ocean, and it builds a shell. And the shell is very strong and very lightweight. And Angie, as she walked the beach, would say, how can it be that these abalone can gather up the components that they need, build this amazing shell, and then when they die, the shell disintegrates back into its basic components in the ocean, just waiting there for the next abalone or the next sea creature to use for something else. And Angie thought, if abalone can build these shells and then die and have them disintegrate without contaminating the environment, why can't we? And one of the underlying themes in the book is, why can't we just use nature's genius to solve some of our problems, rather than cobbling together something that may serve us well, but in the present, but may have really quite serious downsides?
Yeah, it's fascinating. We've talked a lot about CRISPR on this show and kind of gene editing. Is that something that kind of plays into what you're talking about here?
So there are a number of contributions to, where I see the future. Obviously, all of the insights from molecular biology and genomics, it's gene editing, it's understanding DNA and how to manipulate DNA, it's understanding the structure of proteins and how you can tweak them a little bit to make them do what you want to do rather than maybe what they were designed to do. It also calls on the extraordinary insights and progress in computation. That's one of the foundational technologies for all of the things I present.
And it's not that there won't continue to be innovations along those dimensions. Of course there will. But the exciting thing for me is this bizarre combination of advanced computation with advanced genomics. I talk about that in the chapter on food. You know, we're going to need to produce twice as much food as we have on the planet today to feed the anticipated 9.7 billion or more people who will be on the planet by then. And, you know, if we use our current technologies, it will require a doubling of our land, and that would represent the entire landmass of South America and Africa. You know, we're just not going to do that.
Right.
So once again, we're going to have to reinvent agriculture, which we have done in the past. But we need to do it again with all the technologies we can get our hands on.
Well, and you have this common theme through all of these ideas of this interdisciplinary work, basically using the great best ideas from all these different areas. It seems like a no-brainer on its face. Why has it taken us so long to realize, hey, this would be a good idea if we collaborate across different fields?
You know, collaborate is kind of easy to say. There are a lot of syllables and, you know, it doesn't really roll off the tongue, but a lot harder to do. And there are good reasons why it's hard to do. But I think one of the challenges that I talk about in the book, we have to figure out how to overcome the challenges that inhibit collaboration across disciplines. So there is the innovator's dilemma, which is that our current disciplinary structures actually do us pretty well. If you look at my institution or any institution, there is a school of engineering and a school of science. And then within the school of science, there's a department of biology and a department of chemistry. There's a department of mechanical engineering,
right,
and a department of electrical engineering. And, you know, we grow people, we raise people, we educate people, we do our research in these disciplines. And by doing that, we can build on previous knowledge step by step in the most extraordinary way. But what also happens is that we develop a vocabulary unto ourselves and a way of defining problems unto ourselves. And simply throwing engineers and biologists together to say, try to accelerate progress against cancer, which is one of the big initiatives that started at MIT when I was president. You know, you've got to figure out how to map the path so that engineers and biologists can have a shared vocabulary and a shared understanding of the problem. But I have to tell you that I've seen few things that are more catalytic than putting together people from different disciplines around a shared ambition and seeing how they work better and faster and more creatively together in ways that, frankly, no one could have imagined when they were working within their own disciplines.
Yeah, different perspectives coming to the table.
Exactly.
So how do we encourage more of that and talk a little bit about the stakes, if you will, because I know you believe that this is a crucial step for our country to take.
Yeah, the stakes are high. I view this, as I describe it, as the technology story of the 21st century. You know, the technology story of the 20th century, the convergence of physics with engineering, which I call Convergence 1.0, was amazing. If you think about what we had in terms of tools and objects in 1950 and what we have today, you could hardly imagine that it's the same world. The United States led in that cycle of the innovation economy. We developed the ideas. We did the basic research. We turned them into products. We sold the products all over the world. And frankly, for most of that time, we didn't have much competition. Following World War II, the countries that were advanced in science and technology were rebuilding themselves after having had war fought in their country. And so the United States could really own that, and we did, and we did a fabulous job. But now it's very clear how the United States developed an innovation economy, which produced enormous economic gains. And other countries around the world are playing the game, too. And I think that's terrific. I'm very excited. I was delighted when people from various countries would come to my office at MIT and say, we understand how the United States built its innovation economy. We want to do that, too.
Sure.
We need a place like MIT. Help us build a university like MIT. And that's exciting to see the others who are passionate about inventing a better future. Whether the United States is going to be able to compete, I would say more than compete, really lead the way we led in the 20th century, I think is a question up for grabs. It requires a number of things. It requires a real commitment to the fundamental research that sits at the foundation of any of these new technologies. And in the mid-1960s, we were spending roughly 2% of our GDP on research and development. Now we're down to about 0.7, 0.8%. These are federal funds to support the fundamental research. So we've kind of backed off on that commitment. Other countries have accelerated. Several countries spend more, a greater fraction of their GDP than we do. And China, whether it was last week or whether it's next month or next year, will also be spending more than the United States does. to build the foundation from which an innovation economy will be built.
So we have a few minutes left. I want to ask you a little bit about your experience and your background. You served as the first female president at MIT. What did that mean to you, and what do you think about as you kind of look back on that?
You know, at the time when my appointment was about to be announced, it seemed not like anything particularly astonishing. But then as I thought about it, I realized that the generations of women who had come before me had really paved a path that positioned me to be the first woman president of MIT. And I think one of the important things that that does is demonstrate that it's possible. A colleague of mine was walking over to the announcement of my presidency and asked a junior woman colleague whether she was going to go and attend with her. And this younger woman said, you know, I don't have any interest in being the president of MIT, but now I know I could.
Wow.
And it's that sense of possibility. If you can see it, you can be it. And I think the world is changing, never fast enough, but it's going to be important as we wage this competition with other countries that we draw the talent from every source imaginable into this enterprise. And it would be ridiculous, foolhardy, to leave out half of our population because they're women, or a fraction of our population because they are from minorities. This is a passion that some people have, a kind of courage that only some people have, a kind of genius that only some people have, and I want them all to be in the game with us.
So that's obviously an incredible legacy. I think we're also faced with the reality that there still aren't an equal number of women in kind of science and technology fields. What do you think we should be doing? And a lot of studies I've seen show that it really comes down to reaching young girls at an early age, especially in low-income areas. What do you think we need to be doing to kind of encourage that as we move forward?
Well, we need to be making these opportunities more obvious to girls and, frankly, even young men.
Sure.
You know, boys. But I think women, the data show that girls lose enthusiasm for this. They can be soaring at math and science in grade school into middle school, and then it falls off. And it falls off because, you know, socially, it's not something that girls still are not expected to do. It's crazy.
Yeah.
In any case, so among the things, we need better role models. Being president of MIT, I think, doesn't really reach down to fourth graders.
Right, right.
But movie stars? What are our movie scripts? What are they saying about what women do and what men do?
Yeah.
And I'm seeing more and more roles where, you know, girls, women are taking the lead in ways that might encourage women to pursue that. But I think socially we've got to change the way men and women are treated. I think another big problem is imagining that you choose either a career or a family. It can go. You can have both. Maybe not both at the same time, but you can have
both. You can
both.
Make it work.
Yeah.
That's Susan Hockfield. She's president emerita and professor of neuroscience at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Her new book is The Age of Living Machines, How Biology Will Build the Next Technology Revolution. And she'll be speaking with WBUR's Robin Young tonight at the Koch Institute. There's more information about that event at our website, radioboston.org. Susan Hockfield, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Chris Siderick, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Chris Siderick. This is a piece of The Rise Up, a new nearly hour-long composition from musician Mehmet Ali Sandlakal. The work is his most ambitious to date, and it combines jazz music with Turkish and Jewish musical influences. It also weaves together three stories from dark moments in Middle Eastern history that an individual or a group of people were eventually able to overcome or rise above. The Rise Up also has echoes of the personal journey of Sandlakal, who's from Turkey and moved to the United States more than two decades ago, and has witnessed the impacts of increasing anti-Muslim sentiment on him and his community firsthand. Mehmet Ali Sandlakol joins me now in studio. He's a Grammy-nominated musician, composer, and a faculty member at the New England Conservatory. And The Rise Up will premiere on Friday with the jazz orchestra What's Next and featuring NEA jazz master Dave Liebman. Mehmet, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I have a lot to ask you about the incredible scope of this piece and kind of some of those social issues we're talking about, but I really want to start by featuring some of this music because it's really so interesting. And you're premiering on tomorrow night, but one of our producers, the fantastic Zoe Mitchell, got to attend a rehearsal on Sunday and get a little bit of a sneak peek. So let's take a listen to that. So I know this isn't the most musically technical term, but it's so cool. It's so interesting. It feels like there are so many layers there. And I know that you've basically taken jazz music and brought in Turkish influences, Jewish influences. How do you do that? How do you start kind of musically combining all that?
Well, that has a lot to do with my own past. I came to the United States about 26 years ago, only interested in jazz music. I had no knowledge of Middle Eastern music at the time, even though I grew up in Turkey. I was a really very Western-facing Turkish person, which is a typical thing, by the way. You know, most people think that if you grow up in the Middle East, you'll already know all of the customs and musics from that region. But that's not true. Lots of people will be very Westernized, very secular, and so on and so forth. In any case, to make a long story short, 7 years after my arrival in Boston is when I rediscovered my roots and went through an intense decade-long study of my own culture from Turkey, but here in the States, in Boston. And so eventually I came out of that phase and I started being able to hear these unique combinations of these different musical languages. At this point, I could refer to myself as a musically multilingual person. And so after such a period of internalization of these different musical languages, I am able to kind of combine them in ways where they're not just next to each other.
Right. But it feels they all fit as part of the puzzle.
Exactly. It's my voice now.
And it's interesting. This is something that you've done in past works, I know. You did something a little bit more operatic with a take on Othello before,
right,
but also kind of tying these themes together. Right. How does this piece kind of fit into your evolution, mm-hmm, musically speaking?
This probably is the most ambitious composition. It's about an hour long, and I sat down for a good while in order to come up with the right concept that would both make sense for our times today and also for myself as the composer. And so I came up with this concept of the rise up. Just because lately some of us find ourselves in a challenging environment, I wanted to look at especially those moments in Middle Eastern history to show people around the world how there have been very inspirational, transcendental moments when individuals or people rose up and above their trauma and provided inspiration to us all.
So that kind of leads me to my next question, mm-hmm, because this piece features three distinct kind of stories through, mm-hmm, history. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you started with the theme and then identified the stories you wanted to tell within that theme, or if you were thinking about the stories and then realized they had this kind of connective tissue.
You know, I don't remember which one came first.
Right.
What I remember is I wanted the commentary to somehow or in some way highlight the cosmopolitanism of the Middle East, because that's the problem that I always face.
Right.
There is, of course, a great deal of stereotyping. And that's why I went to Middle Eastern history to pick these moments to really demonstrate the universality and cosmopolitanism of where I was raised.
Yeah. So I want to go back to the music a little bit. We only got the second part of the three narratives, so we can't really do a compare contrast, but I want to play a little bit more of, of some of that sound here. All right, so tell us a little bit, if you can, about the stories that you're telling and how you differentiate those stories in one long piece like this.
Sure. So stepping back, the piece is conceived in three different movements. The first movement is about the Muslim mystic Rumi. The second movement is about Sephardic Jewish people. And the third movement is about Sinan the architect. All three experience trauma. In Rumi's case, his beloved teacher Shems was murdered. And yet, after the murder, Rumi somehow rose up and above by composing some of the most beautiful mystical poetry ever written. In the case of Sephardic Jews, their expulsion from Spain is followed by the Ottomans welcoming them in the Ottoman Empire, which then, of course, resulted in a cultural treasure that is still very much with us today. By the way, this is the exact moment when in movement two, toward the end of the second section, when Sephardic Jewish people, supposedly, this is my imagination of their arrival in the Ottoman Istanbul, but there is, of course, this very, you know, unique moment, you know, when they arrive in a geography, a place where they have not known. That's why the music is kind of ambiguous, but you also have this kind of film music-like moment with the call to the prayer. And then finally, in the story of Sinan, who was most likely an Armenian or Greek Orthodox Christian boy in central Turkey, was forcibly converted to Islam by Ottomans, which was a widely practiced thing at the time. But then, you know, after such a trauma, he somehow came to own that identity and rose to become the greatest architect of some of the most sublime mosques that have ever been built.
So I'm curious. Those are three different stories. They obviously have the common theme, but how do you tell those stories in a piece and still have it feel cohesive?
So this is I've composed this piece in a very programmatic fashion. So I really do follow these storylines, and the music very much follows that very, you know, the narrative itself.
Yeah. You spoke when we started about this piece being born out of kind of the current climate that we're in. And we actually had you on the show shortly after the election in 2016, and you were talking a lot about feeling frustration and anger even over rhetoric against Muslims in the United States. I'm curious how you're feeling today about 2.5 years later.
Well, I mean, it comes and goes. I mean, I can't say that it is as bad as it used to be at the time. I'm sure outside factors contribute to this too. It's kind of odd to put it that way, but I guess there haven't been that many terror incidents lately. You know, all of these things contribute because some such things happen and people try to take advantage of them, and then they don't realize that we are, you know, placed in troubling positions in the classroom sometimes. You know, there are unforeseen tensions that can occur. And I have really ended up having to face such tensions in classroom environments, sometimes in talks at concerts, unexpected moments. And you're being put on the spot because you're from Turkey. I'm not a practicing Muslim, but I very much identify with that Islamic identity.
Yeah.
In some ways, if you look at it from a Sufi, a mystical perspective, I guess I am practicing. But I'm not a fundamental, you know, mainstream Muslim who would pray five times a day. And guess what? more than half of Muslims probably are not that way.
Well, it's like any religion. There's a spectrum of how,
But you and I have an easier time saying that, unfortunately, sometimes in a city like Boston, in a classroom environment where, you know, you think you're at some liberal college or whatever, and then suddenly some student comes forward and says something, and you're like, oh, what do I say in response to that? I'm Muslim. If I say something, they'll think of me as defending or whatever. You know,
right.
These positions that you find yourself in are not easy.
Yeah, I'm struck by the fact that despite all of that, I feel like in reading past interviews with you and hearing you talk about these issues, you're still hopeful.
Well, what else is there? You know, we just have to keep up the work. I mean, we just have to keep up doing our part. You know, otherwise, there's no meaning in any of this.
And it all kind of ties back to that theme of rising up, right?
Exactly.
Mehmet, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Mehmet Ali Sandlakal. He's a Grammy-nominated musician, composer, and a faculty member at the New England Conservatory. His latest composition, The Rise Up, will premiere on Friday with the jazz orchestra What's Next and featuring NEA jazz master Dave Liebman at WBUR City Space. More information about that event is on our website, radioboston.org. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Chris Siderick. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.